Yeah, perfect. Okay, hi everybody, and Chodesh Tov. So I'm Dina, nice to meet all of you. What I want to speak about today is Megillat Esther. And the question that I want to address is a question that really we should ask when reading any book, whether a book of Tanakh or even a novel, though obviously with a book of Tanakh even more so, which is to always at some point sort of take a step back and ask, what is the central message that the author is trying to convey with this book? So again, even with a novel, it pays to ask that question, but certainly with a book of Tanakh, all the more so. And in many ways, with the book of Esther, even doubly and triply all the more so. And some of the reason why double and triple all the more so with Megillat Esther is that to a certain degree, because the story is so fun, we often just sort of read it and enjoy the plot line because it's just such a fun story, that we sort of forget to ask, wait one second, why on earth is this book in Tanakh? Right? Like again, it's a great story, it's really fun, it's fantastic that the Jewish people get saved, but there is not one single mention of God's name anywhere in the book. Not only that, there's not really any mitzvot. I mean, arguably we could say, well, at the end they describe the mitzvah of having to celebrate, right, this holiday. But, like, there's no story of, like, brit or covenant with God, right? There's not really mitzvot. There's no even mention of God's name. So, like, why, what is the message of this book? And why is it even in Tanakh? How did it merit to get into Tanakh? What is it that we're supposed to be sort of taking and inculcating into ourselves when we sort of take that step back and try to develop an overview of what is the message that we're supposed to be getting, both from the book and therefore from the holiday. And what in some ways also sort of is a second layer of the question, but the two go hand in hand, as we'll see, is that as we're reading the story of the Megillah, could be that you've noticed this in the past or heard this mentioned, but it is like shocking the number of parallels and allusions that there are in the Megillah to the story of Yosef in Mitzrayim. Okay, again, I don't know if you've heard of that before in a minute, so you can already start thinking. I'll ask you for a few. But as we're going to see, there are like a ton of parallels, literary allusions, similar words that are used. The plot line is very similar between the two stories, which in many ways then also, going back to our original question, makes us ask, what is the message? And whatever that message is, how is that message in some way enhanced or more deeply expressed by all these allusions that it is so crystal clear that in writing the Megillah, they're trying to call our attention to the story of Yosef. So we kind of want to understand both. What is the message in general, and what's the deal with all of these allusions to the story of Yosef? How does that enhance the message? But first, let's even ask, so what are all these allusions? Again, first, even in a global, just the plot line of the stories, it's crazy how strikingly similar they are. Anyone have any ideas? Like, how do we see similarities between the story of Yosef in Egypt and the story of Esther? Yeah.
Excellent.
I would say the most striking parallel is that they are both stories of a Jew in a foreign court, right? And all the more so, but how do both of them begin sort of their stories or their life journeys, so to speak, at the beginning? They're like, what, sorry?
They were stolen. They were taken away.
Exactly. Yes, and like the lowest of the low of society, right? They both begin, right? It's not even like, oh, they just both begin as like a random, you know, Joe Schmo, like average guy on the street. Like way less than that, right? Yosef sort of, again, he first starts, of course, as, you know, just a member of his family, but the real story begins with him finding himself in jail, abandoned by his family, right? Sold, in fact, by his brothers, again, to the point where he's in a pit, and then even in jail. Similarly, Esther starts off not just again as just a random, you know, Joe Schmo of society. She's like the low of the low. She's an orphan, right? The very first thing that we're told about her is Ein la av va'em, right? That she has no parents. She's an orphan. So again, they both sort of start off their journeys as, again, not even just average, but as like the lowest rung. and then have this meteoric rise, so that even though they start as like this lowest rung of society, either again abandoned by their families, again whether obviously Esther not by choice, but sort of alone, abandoned in jail, an orphan, and then rise to be not only, oh, somebody who like makes it okay despite starting low, they make it to be nothing less than second only to the king, right? It explicitly tells us, right, about that Paro tells Yosef, right, that, you know, I'm not even going to withhold anything from you except for the crown, right? Rak hakisei egdal mimeka, right? Only the throne is going to be, like, the only thing. Otherwise, you're literally second in command only to me. And similarly, right, what does Achashverosh famously tell Esther? Repeatedly, when he's, like, begging her, tell me what's on your mind, tell me where you're from. Ar chatzi hamalchut. Vateas, right? Like, I'm willing to give you up to half my kingdom. So that both of them start again on this very low rung and yet rise miraculously to be literally second in command only to the king. Yeah. Excellent, right? This idea of hidden identity is a very central and critical theme in both of them. First of all, they even each have like a hidden name even, right? Like, what's Yosef's name in Egypt? Tzafnat Paaneach, and she, we're really told that what was her real name was Hadassah, he Esther. And in fact, what does the name Esther even mean? Like, Hester Panim, hidden, right? This theme of hidden identity is so, so central to both of them, and largely because of the fact that their hidden identities are so central to the stories. Of course, therefore, each one also has, as like a major climax of the story, the moment of revelation when they each reveal who they actually are, right? For Esther, when she's at the party and finally says, you know, I'm beseeching you, the king sort of wants to know, what's the deal with all these parties? What's on your mind, you know, my queen, and probably expecting her to, I don't know, ask for riches or wealth or maybe a province or two or something like that. And instead, right, she says, my life is at stake. And, you know, who's the terrible man who wants to do this? Haman hara hazeh, right? The point being, there's this like powerful moment of revelation. Similarly, right, by Yosef too, right, his hidden identity is the central theme until that like moment of revelation when he finally says famously, right, Ani Yosef ha'ora v'chai, right, and he reveals himself to his brothers. And interestingly also, each of their stories, kind of the turning point kind of when it begins to turn from being on the low rung to rise, to the rise to power, begins interestingly with troubled sleep of the king, right? Like, what's the famous pasuk right by the Megillah? Balayla hahu nadida shnat hamelech, right? Achashverosh cannot sleep, and therefore he asks his right advisors to come and read from his book of remembrances, and that's how he remembers that in fact Mordechai saved his life with the Bigtan and Teresh episode, and he never rewarded him. And that's sort of what leads again to sort of the turning of Haman's fall and Mordechai's rise. And similarly in the story with Yosef, what begins his rise? How does he get out of jail? When Paro has the dreams and nobody can interpret them, and that's what leads, right, Yosef to be brought out of jail in order to interpret the dreams. It's really like in crazy, right, striking, like how many similarities there are. Yeah. Ah, good, interesting, right? That they're both sort of descendants of Rachel is also, right, an interesting thing that even in terms of their lineage, right, is from similar lineage. Yeah, anyone want to say others? I mean, we've hit on sort of the main ones. There are others as well, and I even want to show you some literary ones. But essentially what we kind of are seeing is that, again, even from the storyline, from them starting off on the low rung, having this meteoric rise to power, the fact that they're both Jews in a foreign court who Dafka used their position to save the Jews, right? Yosef to provide food when they're starving, Esther to save them from Haman's decree. Again, the hidden identity, the moment of revelation, all these pieces are really quite striking. And then, of course, there's even others, like even just the fact that that they both are always finding favor. Like, it's crazy. Like, everybody who meets them just, like, falls in love with them, right? Like, everyone, literally. Yosef, right, starting even from, you know, the jailer likes him and puts him in charge of the jail, right? And the butler and the baker like him, and Paro likes him, and Potiphar's wife likes him, and Potiphar, like, everybody he meets. And similarly with Esther, right, even here it is, right, Hegai Sris HaNashim, who has every every single girl from the entire kingdom gathered before him and somehow singles out Esther to like bring her special like makeup and stuff. And similarly, Ahasuerus could have chosen from any girl in the whole kingdom, miraculously chooses Esther, right? It even says that she finds favor, b'nei chol ro'eh, right? Somehow miraculously, there's many similarities like that. And then if you look at the chart that I brought for you, I think it's page 11, I think, in the book, you'll see, again, don't worry, not going to go through all of them. What I show you here in the chart is that not only what we've just kind of reviewed now is how in terms of the storyline, the plot, there are just like crazy similarities, parallels between the two stories. What I show here in the chart is that linguistically, in terms of the words that are used in writing the psukim of the Megillah, it's so clear and glaringly obvious that they are clearly playing off of the Yosef story. The one that I think is the most striking, if you take a look at number 14 in the chart, it specifically says there, look at the Yosef side first, which is the side on the left, the bracious one. This word, everybody see at page 11? I'm looking at number 14. That word, avayit apak, right, where basically it means this idea of like to sort of get control of yourself, to kind of like hold yourself back and get control of your emotions. This word shows up twice in the Yosef story, right? It says, Vayachat pana vayte vayit apak, right? When he was sort of continuing to hide his identity from his brothers. And can you imagine how like difficult that must have been? Here it is, years he's been away from them and now they show up in front of him. It must have like taken every ounce of self-control, right? To not just tell them right there on the spot, it's me, right, I'm Yosef. But he does, in fact, have to hold himself back till the whole episode plays out. So it says, Vayita Pak. And similarly, bless you, a second time, it also says, V'lo yachol Yosef lihita pak l'chol nisavim. He couldn't continue to hold himself back, and therefore he sends everybody out and reveals himself. But point being, these are the only two times in the entire Chamisha Chumshei Torah that this word shows up. The only time, and it shows up twice in the Yosef story. Therefore, when we are reading, looking then at the right-hand side of the chart, in Megillah Esther, Perakei Pasuk Yud, and it says, Vayit Apak Haman, that Haman kind of has to like get control of his anger at Mordechai until he'll be able to, you know, vent his anger. Vayit Apak, but as soon as we see that word, it's like these bells should like go off in our head of like, wait, I know that word, and it's from the Yosef story where it shows up twice, and again, that's the only place in Torah where it shows up. So that, I think, is even the most glaring. But again, if you look through, there are so many, even looking at number 4 for a second, even the way that Yosef and Esther are described, they're described using almost the identical words, right? Looking at number 4, Esther is Vahanara Yifat Toar Vitovat Mar'eh. And similar to Yosef is Vahi Yosef Yifat Toar Vifei Mar'eh. It's like the exact same description. Looking even at the one right before it, another striking one, and there's much to say about this regarding like other things and what this reflects about Paro, what it reflects about Ahasuerus rather, is that the words that are used to describe, right, Yosef's plan for how to divide the land into sections and appoint officers over each section to gather the food during the years of plenty, is the identical language that is then used in Megillah Esther to describe how Ahasuerus kind of like divide the land into sections and appointed officers to gather all the women. Just read it for a second, you'll see. This is the third one on the chart. Number 3, where it says, Vayafked pikidim al haaretz, vayikbitzu et kol ochel hashanim hatavot. I'm looking at the Yosef side first on the left. Vayitav hadavar beinei paro ubeinei kol avadav. Right, again, they're appointing these officers to be in charge of the different sections. They're gathering all the food of the good years, and the plan is good in the eyes of Paro. And then looking on the right-hand side, the Esther side, vayafked hamelech pikidim, literally the identical phrase. Vayikbitzu, again, they're gathering, et kol na'ara betula tovat mar. Except again, striking that in the Yosef story it's together food and here it's together women. Much to say about that on another time. But again, just the language is so similar. And just one last one that I'll point out is if you look, it's on the back. Again, just but look at even how many. The fact that there's even 21 of these. When it describes, when Haman is sort of presenting this plan, when, again, Ahasuerus asks him, how should I reward somebody that I want to reward? And he's, you know, waxing poetic about how to, you know, put him on the king's horse and give him the king's clothing and call before him. It's, again, so similar to the way that Yosef was ridden around on the king's horse and somebody called before him and he was wearing royal clothing and all that. If you look, it's basically in sources 16, 18, and 20 are actually all like sort of similar about that of describing. Again, if you take a look, you'll notice it where it's describing the veil. Beish tobi day sheish v'yakvu tobi merkevet hamishneh v'yakru'u lefanav. Right, they're calling before him all the things. Again, if you look at both sides, you'll see. Anyway, as I said, I'm not going to go through all of them, but even just at 18, I'm just struck by the giving of the ring. There's just so many parallels. So I hope whatever in your own time, you could take a look and see all the rest. But I hope at this point that I've convinced you that both in terms of the plot, right, and the storyline, and even in terms of the language, that it's clear that the Megillah is playing off of the story of Yosef. But what this just raises, all that, I think just builds the question more. Like, it's interesting to see that, but of course that begs the question of why, right? Again, what is the message of the Megillah, and why on earth did they embed in the story of the Megillah all of these allusions to the story of Yosef? What on earth is the message that we are supposed to be taking from the fact that the story of the Megillah is clearly playing off of that story? What's going on here? So to begin to that's really developing the question. Now let's try to develop some answers. So one thing, first of all, to begin to understand perhaps some of what's going on here, is to actually try to better understand the character of Esther. The character of Esther herself, I actually think, is a remarkable and inspiring character, precisely because of the fact that she undergoes a complete character transformation over the course of the Megillah. Literally, by the end of the Megillah, she is not the same person who we meet at the beginning, like at all. She literally almost like could not be more polar opposite. Take a look and you'll see what I mean. The Esther who we meet, so I'm starting at source number 22 because that's where the psukim sort of start on page 12. The Esther who we're introduced to at the beginning of the Megillah could not be a more passive character. Literally, if there was one word that I would use to describe her as we're introduced to her, I would literally say passive. There are many verbs that show up, right, in relation to her in that first perek where we meet her, which is the second chapter of the Megillah, Perek Bet. Literally every single one is where something is being done to her rather than her taking action. Take a look. It's unbelievable how strong it is. So again, starting in source 22, we're first introduced, and even notice the opposite, where when we're introduced to Mordechai in Pasuk 8, Ish Yehudi Hayab Shushan Habira Ushmo Mordechai Ben Yair, right? We're introduced to him. There was a man, right, in Shushan, and here's his name, right, who was, right, exiled during the exile of Yechaniah, which we're going to come back to. And then look at Zion. Vayehi Omein et Hadassah hi Esther. Meaning, the very way that we're even introduced to her is not even as a character in her own right. We're really meeting Mordechai, who sounds like he's going to be the star of the show. She is merely introduced to us as his appendage, right? Meaning, he's sort of this heroic character. Part of his heroism is that he takes care of this poor orphan girl. But point being, she's not even really introduced as a character. She's really introduced simply in like shedding light on how great Mordechai is, right? That he takes care of her, this poor girl who again doesn't have parents, ema ava em, as it says there. And then take a look. I underlined all the verbs. Where it then says, right, ubimot aviha v'ima likacha Mordechai lo labat. Right, when her parents died, Mordechai took her as a daughter. And again, then in chet, right, when Ahasuerus puts out all of the news about gathering the girls, vatilakach Esther el beit hamelch. She's taken to the palace. And again, in Pasuk Yod, I'm just jumping to the underlines, where it says, Esther would not tell, right, what nation she's from. Ki Mordechai tziva'a leha asher lo tagid. It's not that she herself thought this would be a wise idea, right, to keep it quiet. Mordechai commanded her not to tell, and so she didn't. And again, Pasuk Yud Aleph, right? Every day Mordechai would walk outside where the women are being kept in order to know how Esther's doing. Uma ye aseba, and what is being done to her? Which is, again, the story of her life. Things are always done to her rather than her, right, taking action. Right? Finally, right, it's sort of coming, it describes all the different girls and what happens when it's their turn. And even in Tetvav, again, when it comes to be her turn, it says, Lo biksha davar ki im et asher yomar hegai sris hamelch shomer hanashim. Even in the right harem, she doesn't ask for any lipstick or any perfume or any jewelry. All that was done or given was what Hegai, the sort of guy in charge of all the women, when he told her, oh, this would look nice on you, let me give you a little perfume. Right? But again, she's so passive, even for this guy who presumably is a total stranger, is, you know, sort of directing her in how she should beautify herself to get ready for the king, but she doesn't ask for a thing. And again, Tetzayin Vatilakach Esther Lamelcha Chashverosh, she's taken, right, to the king. And the final, like, clincher is at the end of this perek, right, where we have finally been introduced to her, and realize that by the end of this perek, she is the queen of the land. And yet, even though by the end she is the queen of the land, look at the final pasuk. It says, Ein Esther Magedz Moladas Haviat Ama. Again, she's not telling her birthplace and what nation she's from. Ka'asher Tziva Alehe Mordechai. As Mordechai commanded her, even though, again, she's the queen at this point, and yet still she's just doing what Mordechai tells her. The et ma'amar Mordechai Esther osa kasher haitava amna ito. Even as the queen, all she does is whatever Mordechai tells her. Again, it's very, very striking how, again, just how passive she is. The question is, though, where does the turning point come? Because she certainly does not end the Megillah this way. And the turning point seems to come basically in Perek Dalet. Perek Dalet is where already Haman has made his decree to kill the Jews. Mordechai and all the Jews of Shushan are sitting in sackcloth and they're in mourning. Esther, who's isolated in the palace, doesn't know what's going on. She sees they're all in mourning, but she doesn't know why. So she sends a messenger to go ask Mordechai what's going on with all these mourning practices. And he basically sends back, letting her know about this terrible plot that has been hatched against her and the Jews. And he says to her famously, looking on page 13, he famously says to her, this is the underlined part at the end of Pasuk Chet, where he says, "Ulitzavot aleha, lavo el hamelech litchanein lo, ulevakesh mafanav alama." He tells the messenger Hatach, right, go to Esther and tell her she needs to go to the king and beg and plead on behalf of her nation. However, she basically says, right, as we know, she's afraid. And totally at this point, still fitting within the lines of the character who we met in Perek Bet, totally passive, totally afraid to ever take initiative or take action, she basically says, no, I can't do it. I haven't been called before the king for 30 days. Right, again, that's the underline in Pasuk Yud Aleph, where she says, V'ani lo nikreti lavo el hamelech ze shloshim yom, right? I can't do it, Mordechai, right? Go find somebody else. Go find some other plan. But this is where Mordechai will not let her off the hook, right? And Mordechai says to her, and I think it's such a powerful pasuk. There's two of my favorite pasukim, this one and the next one we'll come to, where he basically says to her in Pasuk Yud Gimel, Al tidami binafshech lihimaleit beit hamelch mikol hayudim. Do not just think to yourself that you alone will escape because you're, you know, safe in the palace. Ki im hacharesh tacharishi ba'et hazot. If you remain silent at this moment, revach v'hatzala ya'amod la'yehudim mimakom acher. Somehow, we will be saved. Salvation will come to us somehow else. V'at ubeit avich tovedu. But you and your father's house will be lost. Umi yodea im la'et kazot higat l'malchut. And who knows if it might not be for this very moment. This is your moment, Esther. This might be why all these events have played out the way that they did, that you've somehow become the queen. Don't remain silent. Don't miss this golden opportunity. This is maybe why it's all happening. And amazingly, the like, right, Nafal Asimon, like, it clicks. Like, she gets it. This speech, this impassioned plea that Mordechai makes, it penetrates, and she gets it. And literally, look at the next pasuk. She literally, this is the turning point, really, I would say, in Esther's entire character. And she responds in Pasuk Tet Vav, right? Vatomer Esther lahashiv al Mordechai, lech kinos et kol ha-yehudim. Go and gather all of the Jews who are found in Shushan and fast for me and don't eat and don't drink for 3 days, right? Laila vayom, and I'm also going to do the same thing. And I, in fact, will go before the king. I will plea on behalf of my people, make the plea. V'kasher avadati avadati. And if I am lost, I will be lost. But, like, I get it, Mordechai. I get it that this is the moment and that I need to seize this moment and do my best on behalf of my people. And remarkably, the pasuk right after this, the closing pasuk, is Yedayin, Vaya'avar Mordechai, Vaya'as Kichol Asher Tzivta Alav Esther. Mordechai goes and does all of what Esther commanded him. The tables have literally turned 180 degrees, where up until now, she is so passive, all she does is what he commands her. Now suddenly, he is doing exactly what she has commanded him. But again, it is literally a complete and utter, like, transformation in character that suddenly she, again, because of this speech, right, that Mordechai has given, that suddenly she takes action. And from this point in the Megillah on, she is really the one who calls the shots, right? The idea to fast, the idea to gather all the Jews, all the rest of it, she is really the main, right, protagonist of the Megillah. We even call it Megillat Esther, not Megillat Mordechai, or even Mordechai v'Esther. It's really called after her. From this point on, it is literally as if she is a different person. And then we're going to see the final climax in a second, but yeah, question? Good. So some of it, right, the Masechet Megillah actually raises that part of what she was afraid of, and the Kasher Avadati Avadati is, if I'm lost to you, I'll be lost to you. That part of the passivity was, at least then it's kind of like rape and it's not her fault, whereas now she's initiating, and therefore, again, the Masechet Megillah also raises maybe she was married to Mordechai and then she won't be able to go back to him. There are those possibilities, but it's still clear that even if we're going to justify some of her passivity because of that, still all the rest of it, again, the whole Perek Bet, there is not a single active, you know, verb used by her, and suddenly here she becomes so active. The transformation is so striking. And what I want us to see is that it's not just Esther, that Esther is representative of the entire time period. And I think that's what's also so critical, is that on the one hand, we can sort of read the Megillah and we can read the character of Esther and her transformation, right, as just sort of the personal story of this one woman, who again could still serve as an inspiration to us and as a role model, but it would still sort of remain as the story of one individual who again sort of undergoes this transformation and saves her people. But I think it's much, much more than that. If we take a step back and appreciate the time period during which the Megillah is taking place, it totally, I think, also like transforms the whole story and our whole understanding of why Esther was exactly the heroine that was needed at that time. Which is that I know for years and years, I always just kind of read the Megillah in a vacuum, right? Like, as I said, it's just such a fun story, right? Just a great plot with all these twists and turns and moments of revelation and all these, right? Like, it's just a great story. And therefore, I think right, one tends to just read it, again, sort of in a vacuum, ahistorically. However, Rav Nachum Liebtag was the first who I read about this, but many articles have been written about this, that if we actually don't do that, if we don't read it in a vacuum, but if instead we ask, what else is going on sort of in Jewish history at this time? When is this story happening? It is actually like shocking and disturbing, honestly, to realize that the story of Purim, right, when does it happen? Anybody know? It's happening in between, basically, the two Batei Mikdash, right? Meaning, the first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, right, by Bavel, Nebuchadnezzar Melech Bavel. And in stark contrast to the tragic Galut that we're in the middle of now, where we don't really know, it just sort of seems endless, and we don't really know when the end point is going to be, and it really has been going on for quite a long time. That first Galut, after the first Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, they knew, even before it was destroyed, exactly how long the Galut would last. Yirmiyahu prophesied to them that it would be 70 years, which is actually kind of like crazy to think about for a minute, that like the self-same people who might have witnessed the burning of the first temple as children might have been the self-same people who actually got to, like, rebuild the second Beit HaMikdash, right, as, say, you know, older, right, people. But, I mean, it's only 70 years. There could have, and probably were, people who actually were alive through the whole thing to see the destruction, to live through the Galut, and actually witness the rebuilding, because it was, again, a relatively short time period. However, what's shocking about when the Megillah happens, according to most people, is that it was after Koresh had already given his declaration, kind of like the Balfour Declaration, right? Like, allowing, looking with favor upon, right, the establishment of a Jewish homeland in Israel, allowing the Jews to return to their homeland. Now, the reason that that simple, like, piece of historical information, to me, like, totally transformed, like, the way that I understood the Megillah, was that it raises all of these kind of, like, troubling or disturbing questions of, oh my gosh, like, what were Mordechai and Esther doing there in Shushan? If Koresh has already given his version of the Balfour Declaration, allowing Jews to go back to Eretz Yisrael and start the project of rebuilding Bayit Sheni, then again, what on earth are Mordechai and Esther doing still in Shushan? They should be in Israel, right, helping rebuild the Second Temple. And interestingly, Masechet Megillah actually asks, right, why were the Jews at that time period deserving of near destruction? Meaning, we tend to read the Megillah as this, like, awesome, like, happy, like, festive story because it has a happy ending. But, right, through most of the story, we have to realize for the Jews living at that time, yes, it ends, right, on this happy note, but they come to within, like, a hair's breadth of, like, being wiped out. And therefore, we have to ask, well, like, what made them sort of deserving of, like, coming that close and having to live with that anxiety of not knowing, will this, in fact, have a happy ending in the end? And interestingly, Masechet Megillah asks that question, and one of the famous answers that it gives is, why were the Jews deserving of near destruction? Because they went to the party, right, that we're told about in Perek Aleph of the Megillah, right, that Ahasuerus throws that big party and invites all the people, and that the Jews went and participated in the party. Now, of course, that would raise the obvious question of, okay, maybe they shouldn't have gone, but, like, is that so bad to deserve near extinction? And again, the Gemara explains that what was Ahasuerus celebrating at that party? Why did he really make that party? Right? And we're probably familiar with this because when we read that pasuk in the Megillah, we change to the tune of Eicha. Right? When we read Vishotim Mikelim Shonim, right? We do it, if I wasn't tone deaf, I would do it, but I can't do it. Right? We turn to the tune of Eicha and we do it in the mournful tune. Why? Because Chazal tell us that those Kelim that he brought out to serve drinks at his party were the Kelim from the Beit HaMikdash. And why was he bringing them out at this party? Because the entire reason why he was making this celebration was that he calculated 70 years, but he calculated wrong, say Chazal, and therefore he said, ah, the 70 years are up, and look at this, the Jews have not been redeemed. Clearly they're not going to be redeemed. Hooray, like, let's throw a party to celebrate the fact that the Jews are not being redeemed, and that was the entire point of the party. If that's what the entire point of the party was to celebrate the lack of redemption, then we can understand why the Jews' participation in a very party whose purpose, right, is to celebrate their lack of redemption, the fact that God is not, right, letting them rebuild the Second Temple. Like, of course, oh my gosh, like, yeah, that I understand then might merit getting this decree of Haman made against them. Now, why, though? To shake them out of their apathy, meaning, it really appears from many, actually, of the Nevi'im and the Achronim at that time period that really the rampant problem that literally was rampant throughout the Jewish people at that time was, again, if I had to sum it up in one word, was apathy. They just didn't care. And all of these prophets, right, like the last of the prophets, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, Ezra, Nehemiah, they're all railing against the Jews and trying to, like, grab them by their shirt collars and, like, shake them and say, like, get up and, like, go and build the Beit HaMikdash. A lot of what they even have to tell them is, like, divorce your foreign wife. They were intermarried even. Like, there was just a total lack of passion. And if you take a look, even, for example, I just brought as one example, but there's really many. If you look at source number 25 from Haggai, who's one of the last of the prophets, again, he's prophesying right exactly at that time of Shivat Zion. It should be on page 13 of your books. Chagai says in Perek Aleph, again, I'll just read the underlined part, where he says, Ko amar shem tzvakot lemor, ha'am hazeh amru lo eit bo eit beit Hashem hibanot. It's not time yet to go back and rebuild the Beit HaMikdash, right? And therefore God has to send, right, Chagai the prophet with the message saying, ha'eit lachem atem lashevet b'vateichem sfunim v'abayit hazeh harev. Why are you sitting in your beautiful paneled homes when my house is sitting in ruins? Like, get yourselves up and go to Eretz Yisrael and build my temple. Like, what are you doing here? And you can sense the frustration of all the Jewish leaders at that time, again, of Chagai, of Ezra, of Nehemiah, who again are just trying to like shake the Jews out of their apathy and trying to like inspire them to go up, to get out of the Galut, to go back to Eretz Yisrael, and to try to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. And again, even jumping down in that, in Source 25 to Pasuk Chet, the next underline, where he even says to them, Alu hahar vavetem etu banu habayit, like, get yourselves up, go up the mountain, get some wood, and build this house. Like, why are you just sitting here? And that's clearly a major theme that goes out throughout sort of this whole time period. And with that background of appreciating that this is happening during Shivat Zion, that they could have gone back, that the rampant problem throughout all the Jewish people at this time is this apathy, now we can understand why Esther was exactly the heroine that they needed. Because she starts the Megillah as like literally an example par excellence of exactly every single one of them, right? Totally apathetic, right? I earlier was using the word passive, but we really could also use the word apathetic, right? Somebody who's passive, who isn't taking action, just kind of doesn't seem to care. And whatever happens to her, all right, so whatever happens, happens. You want to send me here, I'll go here. You want to send me there, I'll go there. You think I shouldn't tell my birthplace, I won't tell my birthplace, right? Like, she just is whatever you tell me to do, right? She's totally passive and totally apathetic. And it's only as a result of that impassioned speech that Mordechai gave her in Perek Daled that we read when he says, this is your moment, Esther. This is maybe why you've made it to be second in command to the king, that she has that total turnaround. But the point is, I think that God is trying to set Esther up as a model for the whole time period of trying to say that transformation that Esther underwent as an individual is supposed to be like a demut l'mofet, to be a role model to all of like the whole generation. And again, if it's in Tanakh, it means a model for not just that generation, but all future generations as well, to like shake ourselves up out of our apathy and to care. And that's why my second favorite pasuk, as I mentioned, there were two. One is that impassioned speech that Mordechai gives. My other one is the one that I brought in source number 24 from Esther Perkhet, where after she has basically revealed her identity at the party to Achashverosh and sort of said, you know, I'm a Jew and there's Haman Harahazeh, right? But still, like, even though now he knows who she is and who Haman is and whatever, like, there's still the problem of, like, this decree is out there to kill the Jews on Yud Gimel Adar. And Yudalad Adar, they basically say, oh no, it is Yud Gimel, Yudal is the celebration. Anyway, they say in Pasuk Vav, right, listen to what Esther says. I love this pasuk. She says to Achashverosh, Ki eichacha uchal v'ra'iti bra'a asher yimtza etami. How could I possibly just sit back and watch this evil thing befall my nation? Ve'eichacha uchal v'ra'iti ba'avdan moladati. How could I possibly just sit back and watch, like, my birthplace, my nation, be destroyed? To me, that pasuk, it, like, literally, in that one line of that one pasuk, captures, I think, literally, the message that the Megillah is trying to convey to us. Is that sense that Esther starts the Megillah as this totally passive, totally apathetic character, and yet by the end, she feels that sense of, like, Am Yisrael's pain is her pain. It is like literally in her, like in her kishkas, like, like, I couldn't. It's like inconceivable to her that she could possibly just sit back and watch matters unfold. Even though you and I, as we're reading the Megillah, and as we read that pasuk, we could be thinking, well, the person that we met in Perek Daled, when Mordechai first told you, go to the king and plea on our behalf, you were perfectly content then to be like, well, no thanks, and I wasn't called before the king for 30 days, please find somebody else. Like, do you know what I'm saying? Like, it's crazy when we read that pasuk in Perek Chet, she's a different person, where again, she feels the pain of Am Yisrael in her gut, where she cannot not conceive of the possibility of sitting by and not doing anything, even though the person we met at the beginning was perfectly happy to do exactly that. But she has completely undergone this transformation. And again, I think the transformation that she as an individual has undergone is exactly the message, one of the central messages of the Megillah, that really the Megillah is supposed to be inspiring all of us. And all the all of the people of that time period in particular. But again, really, if it's written, Nevuah that was written means it's right who Tzrucha Lado wrote. For all of us also is to feel like the pain of Am Yisrael in our guts and to be the type of people who don't just sit back and watch things happen, but really take action. And to tie it all back, one of the other major questions that we started with is, but what about all those parallels to the Yosef story, right? Like, we developed all these parallels. What does that Yosef story have to do with any of this? And what I would suggest, there's many different answers that could be suggested, but one that I would suggest in light of all of what we've been developing is that, as we've sort of seen, in many ways, Yosef and Esther are these, like, insanely parallel stories, so strikingly similar. However, there is at least one way, in which they literally could not be more polar opposites. And that is, in particular, the degree to which they do or do not, like, at least give attribution explicitly to the hand of God. Meaning, as we mentioned, in the story of the Megillah, Megillah Esther, the glaring, like, the character who is most glaringly absent is God. God's name is not mentioned a single time in the entire Megillah, right? The Yosef story could not be more extremely opposite in this regard. All the time, everything that happens to an extreme, Yosef is always attributing everything to God, literally even to an extreme. To the point where even when Paro says to him, wow, could there be anybody as wise as you in the whole kingdom who has this amazing plan? You interpreted my dream, and not only did you interpret my dream, but you even have a plan of how to solve the problem, right? To gather the food during years of plenty, right? And he says, nobody's as wise as you. And what does Yosef say? He says, no, it's not me, it's God, right? He's talking to Paro over here, and still he's saying, no, it's not me, right? Everything is really God. God interpreted your dream. God gave me the idea for the plan. Everything that happens, again, if you look in the last set of psukim that I brought for you, right, this is where he says, right, he answers, he says, "Biladai Elokim yaneh Shlom Paro." And not only that, but again, looking even at the earlier sources, when everybody's loving Yosef, right, it's Vayhi Hashem et Yosef, Vayar Adonav ki Hashem ito, V'cho Asher hu asa Hashem hitzliach biyado. It's like crazy how literally everything is God, 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 God. Even, I would even suggest that the most extreme piece where he's always attributing it to God is that when Yaakov dies, the brothers are terrified that maybe Yosef has only been nice to them all along because he, like, you know, doesn't want to make his father Yaakov upset. And so when Yaakov dies, they're terrified that, oh, now he's suddenly going to, like, change colors, right, and sort of take his vengeance out on us. And what does Yosef say in order to, like, sort of calm them down and reassure them that really he's not going to? He said, don't worry. It wasn't really you. I know that you sold me, but, like, really it was God's plan to send me here. And I have to say, it's always even been a little bit upsetting to me because I always think, like, okay, that might be true that getting Am Yisrael down to Egypt was part of God's plan, but, like, your brothers didn't have to sell you to get you there. Like, God could have figured something else out. Like, they really should not actually wipe their hands clean. And similarly, also by the Yosef story, a piece that kind of always disturbed me, it's a famous midrash, right, where it says that after he interprets the dreams of the Sar HaOfim and the Sar HaMashkim, and he tells him, remember me to Paro, right? And then he forgets, and it's only when 2 years later Paro has his dreams and nobody can interpret them, and then he's like, oh, right, et chatai ani maskir hayom, that really there's this guy in jail who interprets dreams, and I forgot, right? And what do Chazal say? That why did that happen, that he forgot and that Yosef had to be in jail 2 extra years? Because of the fact that he was putting his trust in a human being instead of, right, trusting God to get him out of jail. And again, that always bothered me, of, like, what do you mean? Maybe God sent, like, the Sar HaMashkim into jail so that Yosef could, like, the fact that he has a Sar HaMashkim doesn't mean he didn't trust God. And, like, both of those pieces bothered me, both, again, about him getting in trouble for asking the Sar HaMashkim to remember him, and the fact that he kind of, like, wipes the brother's slate clean by saying, oh, God, like, sent me here. However, what I think could potentially be suggested is that maybe the reason why that's all going on in the Yosef story is that the Yosef story and the Esther story, I really think, are in many ways very similar, but they express the exact mirror image messages of each other, and therefore they have to be read one in light of the other, because each gives a very extreme message that we need to get. Like, often if we don't get messages in the extreme, if they're like a little bit like too nuanced sometimes, like, we lose them. So each one expresses its message in very extreme form in order to like fully convey the strength of the message, but it's like put in light of the other so that the two in light of each other balance each other out. Let me explain what I mean. The Yosef story, I think, is a story whose message is faith in God. Faith in God, that God's hand is working, and that even when something happens that seems terrible, like your brother's abandoning you and selling you as a slave and throwing you into a pit and like all that stuff, right? Looks horrible, and it looks like, how could this be happening to me, and how could my brothers turn on me? God's hand is really there. He's working behind the scenes. God is pulling all the strings and is making everything happen. And in many ways, I think that is the, or at least one of the central messages of the Yosef story, which is why Yosef himself is constantly attributing everything to God. The psukim are constantly saying, Hashem matzliach biyado, God is the one who's making Yosef find favor and him being successful, etc., etc. That's why Yosef almost even gets in trouble when he does what I would think is just doing proper hishtadlus, right? But like, no, the message of the Yosef story is how God's hand is really pulling all the strings and orchestrating everything. On the flip side, the message of the Megillah is, again, in many ways, the polar opposite. The message that is trying to be conveyed by the Megillah is, don't be passive. Don't be apathetic. Feel the pain of the Jewish people in your gut to the point where we should all, each one of us, feel that sense of, how could I possibly ever just sit back and watch something bad like happen to my nation? We should all feel that. In order to like fully feel that sense of like, how could I ever just sit back and let this happen? We almost need a little bit to like not have the name of God in the Megillah, right? Because if the name of God is in the Megillah, then there could be the sense of like, well, God is gonna take care of it. So like, I can just sit back and like let somebody else handle it, let somebody else take care of it, right? God will take care of this. It's only when we feel a sense of like personal responsibility, I am not casting this off on anybody else. I'm not even casting this off on God. I, me, myself, like, not relying on, I need to feel that sense of, like, it is on my shoulders to do everything that I possibly can. I need to not be apathetic. I need to, like, be the one, it's easier to say this, right, in Israel than to give this year in America, right? I need to be the one who's going to, like, get myself up and do my piece, right, and come to Eretz Yisrael if now is the time when we can, and do whatever else I can, right, to contribute to Am Yisrael and not just rely on, right, God to do it somehow else. But in order to do that, again, it sort of has to be very extreme and literally not even have the name of God mentioned at all. And so I think that each one, especially again, as these stories of Jews with hidden identities, starting from the lowest rung, raising to be second in command, saving their nation, I think each one, though, shares this very, very powerful message. Yosef, of like, everything is really God orchestrating. Esther, the message, and again, especially was the message that her time period needed, of like, we human beings need to invest every effort. We, every single one of us, needs to feel as if it is on our personal shoulders alone. I need to do what I, you know, my piece. And therefore, again, the name of God has to be omitted. But that's why I think the two stories are in light of each other. Because for the Esther message, again, going back to the question I started, what is the message of the Megillah? Again, I think there certainly could be other messages as well. But certainly, I would argue that one of the central messages, if not the central one, is this idea of the transformation that Esther undergoes from being totally passive and totally apathetic to being somebody who feels, again, the pain of Am Yisrael in her gut, who feels this personal sense of Eichacha Uchavra Itibra Asherim Satami. And for every one of us, I really think that is, again, at least the, if, like, one of, if not the central messages of feeling that sense of responsibility to do every piece that we possibly can to contribute to our communities, to our nation, to like, to Am Yisrael. But I think that they parallel that to the Yosef story, because in order for the Megillah to fully give that message, they need to almost like downplay God. And so they do that, but like, we don't want to do that too much. And so like, we parallel it to Yosef, who like overplays God, again, almost also to an extreme, about like almost wiping the brother's slate clean and having to be in jail 2 extra years. But again, I think it's because it's the two in light of each other, which are such similar stories, but it's only each one is conveying this very opposite piece, because each one has its place and its time, and a time when we need, right, to have bitachon in Hashem, and it's the time when we need to say, I'm going to do my piece. And therefore, I think it's the two in light of each other that really fully complete the circle to fully sort of give this message of the balance. And it's really a question about like knowing when is each time. But I think the story of the Megillah is the one that's giving the message of like that feeling, that sense of personal responsibility to do everything that we possibly can.